When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
In a sudden flash, it all comes clear. It's a eureka moment, an epiphany. Hi, I'm Marcus Smith, host of the Constant Wonder podcast. The world offers marvel, meaning, and mystery around every single corner. In nature, art, science, culture, history, we talk everything from bees and beetles to obelisks and asteroids. Experience the thrill of transformative encounter. We'll bring more wonder to your day.
Listen to Constant Wonder wherever you get your podcasts.
Before we start our episode today, this is just a reminder. History Hack does have a Patreon account and all of your donations are gratefully appreciated. There's lots of perks on there, secret groups on Facebook. Do get involved. We would love to see more of you. Enjoy the episode today.
Hello and welcome to another episode of History Hack. It's Lockie in the chair today for reasons which will become apparent immediately. We are very much in my lane. We're talking about sport, but it's that sport which features the toughest, most intelligent, sophisticated, funniest, best looking competitors. We are talking rugby union, of course, but we're also drifting into the realms of 99 calls and the Everest speech. As well. Joining me are Chris Schumann and David McLennan. These gents have, well, this is not their first bit of work that we're talking about today. They've collaborated on a history of rugby at Newlands, the big stadium in Cape Town. But there are other books that they've worked on, including some great war stuff, which I'm really, really excited about, as you could expect. But we're talking about lions in Africa, the British and Irish Lions and the Hunt for the Springboks, which is the new book that they have coming out. Well, in this country later this month. How are you, gents? You well?
I'm complaining.
Oh, thank you.
Good. All right. Well, how are you enjoying the tour that's on at the moment? We're all excited. The final test is coming up. What do you reckon?
Well, there've been two tours, the 1903 and the 1910 tour, where they were level pegging after two. And then there was the deciding test. And in each case in Cape Town, if you're looking at history, I'm afraid the Springboks are going to win because that was what happened in those two cases. But gosh, it's been a grinding series, I have to say. Very hard rugby. I don't know. Who knows? There might even be a draw on Saturday, but it's certainly going to be a tough game.
You in agreement, Chris?
Yeah, I see that Jonathan Davies, the former Welsh fly-off, he's complaining about the type of rugby that they're playing. You know, it's too dull, and he's appealing to world rugby to change the laws, to speed up the game or to open it up more. You know, than something different from what we've been seeing over the past two Saturdays. You know, there was a lot of kicking, as you recall. You know, just thinking about what the great Cliff Morgan said, you know, in 55 after that first test, which was a fantastic test. They still regarded this the most spectacular, you know, ever played in South Africa. And they had something like 19,000 spectators at Ellis Park.
90.
What did I say?
19.
No, 90. 90, some say, even say 96. But anyway, it was a Cliff Morgan said, you know, I can just read it to you. To me, that game epitomized what rugby and the tour were about. Adventure style, passing the ball and taking chances. And he was very much one for taking chances, for taking risks. And he said, you know, otherwise the game becomes poorer. And that is probably what we are seeing at the moment, you know, with this current series.
Yeah, I think I'm with you. I'd love to see a bit more creativity and invention. I don't like to take away from the forward battle at all. I'm a big second row myself, and I think that's a big part of the game, and always has been. And I guess that kind of leads us into the book. I mean, tell us a little bit about it. What's its purpose?
Well, there hasn't been a book put together on all the Lions tours. Well, you know, initially they were obviously not called the Lions. They were just called British Isles teams.
British Isles, yeah.
And they were selected on a fairly sort of random basis. Certainly the 1891, you know, members of the team tended to come from Oxford and Cambridge and sort of England. It was not as professional as it's done now, obviously. But we thought that, you know, we would put it together. When we started the process, you know, we were expecting 30 to 40,000 fans to come from England, well, from the British Isles to support the Lions. And of course, that's all gone by the board, which is incredibly disappointing. And we thought, you know, that was the background. It was as simple as that. You know, the individual tours have been mostly covered, or certainly the later ones. But nobody's really looked individually at the early tours. So that was what I did. And then we put it all together to give a sort of potted history in a way, which is what we planned.
Yeah, I think that's quite valuable, because I think some of the kind of more recent South Africa tours, and probably from 74 onwards, I think they're fairly fresh in the mind, aren't they? And for a lot of people kind of watching rugby nowadays, maybe some of their earlier rugby memories. Me, for example, some of my earliest rugby watching, getting excited memories were maybe the 97 Lions tour in South Africa. So Lions in South Africa is huge for rugby fans here as well. The forward, I mean, the forward of your book, one of your forwards was written by Willie John McBride as well, Lions legend, of course. And one of the points he makes in his forward is the kind of difficulty of leaving politics at the door, and how much he kind of insisted on doing that, because I think there's a feeling that people would like to leave politics behind when we come to sport, but that's rather difficult, actually, especially in South Africa since the late 19th century, because it seems to be surrounded by that. Do you have any kind of problem sort of blending the two subjects, sport and politics, together?
Well, I think from my point of view, from the earlier point of view, you know, when I wrote the book, I didn't know what obviously Mr. McBride was going to write. But I make the point, you know, even in 1896, when the British Isles team came out here, when they visited Pretoria, which was a country that had basically gone to war with England in 1881, they'd fought a full-scale war and were about to fight 3 years later, would fight another one.
Well, let's go into that a little bit then, because you've got on that tour, some of the players go off and visit Doornkop as well, don't they? Which is, you know, the site where the Jameson raid came a cropper. And this is precursor to Second Boer War, the big South Africa war stuff, isn't it? So you got really quite significant political goings on around there. How was, say, the British Isles touring team visit to Doornkop seen at the time in South Africa?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, the fact was, at that time, rugby was largely dominated by English-speaking and people from England. So they had come out mainly to mine, either in Kimberley or in Johannesburg. But, you know, I make the point that even by 1896, you were beginning to get Afrikaans-speaking people playing rugby. President Kruger of the ZA was an odd contrast. You know, he believed the world was flat. He believed he was a very conservative man, but at the same time, he was shrewd. He was very shrewd. And so he allowed them to visit his country and play games in Johannesburg. He gave his permission. I couldn't find any reaction, but you know, it We have an exact situation now. Our ex-president, Mr. Zuma, is in fact in jail in KwaZulu-Natal. One can only imagine if the present Lions visited him in jail. Yeah. I mean, Mr. Johnson in Parliament would have to answer questions. So I can't answer your question. I don't know. I suspect Mr. Kruger was probably pretty unhappy that they went to see the Raiders in prison in Pretoria before sure. they played the game there. But at the same time, you know, Kruger was shrewd. He allowed the Raiders to enter the ZAR. He just watched them. He just sent his commandos until they trapped them at, as you correctly say, Doornkop, where there was a loss of life and the battle was over. It must have annoyed him. At the same time, you know, the First Boer War, which, as you again correctly say, was not nearly as intense as the bigger one in 1899, 1902. But in 1880, Britain annexed the Zuid-Afrikaanse Republic. They sent troops from Durban. They marched into Pretoria. They took down the ZAR flag and raised the Union Jack. In retrospect, it's extraordinary that they could do that. I mean, it was a handful. It was a platoon of men. And they then controlled the Transvaal for about 3 years. And then that ended when the Battle of Majuba, when the Boers, you know, won the battle. Famously, you know, General Colley, who was killed on the summit of Majuba, was the first British general to die since Waterloo. There'd not been another man of that rank killed. And, you know, it's a famous story in South Africa. You know, the Boers, it's on a Sunday, the Boers sing their psalms, the British hear them singing, they are down in the valley, and then they set off and they climb up the hill and they win the battle. So maybe Kruger felt, how can I put it, that they put one over the British, and so, well, they were welcome to come and have another try, and, you know, I don't know.
I'm always in danger of kind of derailing kind of podcasts with talk about military history, because that's definitely my thing. I do love the link between the army and rugby at that time, because then you sort of look at players from those tours actually fighting in South Africa as well and becoming quite highly decorated. In fact, let's do something controversial. Let's talk about rugby for a second and the tours themselves. And I'm kind of drawn to those early tours. And we can talk about the later tours, and we certainly will do in a few moments. But what these schedules that these players played to were off the chain, weren't they? Complete lunacy as far as the number of games they would play and the frequency and the intensity of them. Let's talk about that for a moment.
Look, they learned their lessons. I mean, the first tour, they bought 21 players. By 1910, I think they had 28 players. But, you know, coming to our fields, I mean, our fields now, you know, that you'll see on Saturday are nothing like they used to be. I mean, there was no watering of the fields. So the fields were incredibly hard. And in Kimberley...
Kimberley was notorious, wasn't it?
It was notorious.
Gravel patch.
Yeah, after 1891, the British players shrewdly came and they actually wore kind of a knee pad. But the descriptions are terrible. I mean, some of the men were very badly cut around their faces. You know, they would be, if you think of how you get tackled in a modern game.
Yeah. And
one of the British journalists, which I quote, said, you know, there were at least three blades of grass on the Kimberley pitch. And in a later tour, the British players dug up a bloody boulder, or not, you know, a big rock. And the Griqualand West Rugby Union, which controls rugby in Kimberley, denied this strenuously. But, I mean, it was absolutely true. I'm sure of it.
Yeah.
So the conditions were appalling. And they made the players. This is why it's interesting to me, you know, this tour, Mr. Gatland's tour, you know, seven matches. I mean, these guys were playing 20, 27, 28 games, 21 games. whatever it was, and they were playing Wednesday, Saturday, Wednesday, Saturday, and traveling between on a train.
Yeah, no, that's it. And not just jumping on a plane to go to the next venue, were they? These slow-moving trains, which could take all day to do a couple of hundred kilometres.
Yeah, it's interesting interesting what David said, you know, that 1891 tour, they only had 21 players, you know, no bomb squads, you know, like you have today, you know. How did they get by? It's amazing.
Yeah, your star player gets crocked in game one, and all of a sudden you're down to 20, and things look tough and tight, and yeah.
No, you think of, you couldn't replace players, so if you were injured, which, you know, happens. And then the other thing that the South Africans did, and I mean, by 1938, the last tour that I wrote about, I mean, we'd honed it to a really, I mean, Steve Lewis, who's written the definitive book on the 1938 tour, he drew a graph about, you know, how they traveled. So we sent them from the coast to the Highveld, back down to the coast, back up to the Highveld. We sent them to the desert, to Kimberley, where they played on gravel. Then you would go back down to Durban, where it's tropical. Then you would go up to the Hive. I mean, South African authorities made it as hard as possible. And it's interesting to me because in the 2009 tour, there was evidently a lot of negotiations. It wasn't just about whether in the press it was, oh, you know, the tour, the people who are following the tour want to go to Cape Town. You know, it was all around how many games you play on the coast where the fields are softer and how many games you play on the Highveld in Bloemfontein or in Ellis Park where it's very high. And obviously from the South African point of view, we want to play on the Highveld. From the Lions' point of view, they want to play in Durban, Port Elizabeth or Cape Town.
Yeah. I wonder if there's anything in the kind of venue choices for later tours, because this final game's in Johannesburg, isn't it?
No, it's in, they all three have been in
Cape Town. Oh, they're all in Cape Town. Oh, sorry. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, still, yeah, no, the kind of moving around makes it difficult to acclimatise. Do you have a favourite tour that you like to refer to? Either of you? A favourite kind of one particular?
Well, you want to start, David, or shall I go?
I'll start briefly. Look, from my series, my section as a South African, the 1903 tour where Mark Morrison, who was a Scot, led the tour.
Yeah.
We won. The first two games were draws, and the third game, South Africa won, and that was the first series. You know, we'd lost in 1891, we'd lost in 1896. And that series is famous from our point of view because we were not defeated again in a series until 1956 in New Zealand. So that sort of started our. So I would say that is, from a South African point of view, a celebrated tour. And my last tour that I wrote about, the 1938 tour, was a fantastic tour. Sam Walker was the captain. Donnie Craven was the South African captain. South Africa won it 2-1. They won the first two tests. And the third test was played at Newlands. And it was, I mean, Chris has talked about the 55 test. The 1938, the third test was a fantastic test. The Lions won. But they, you know, all the reports about the game, the last 20 minutes, the entire crowd were on their feet. And in the final moments, the Lions, led by a guy who would later get four DSOs in the war, Paddy Mayne, who was extracted from jail by David Stirling to start the SAS. He leads the charge, and they charge downfield, the forwards, brushing the South Africans aside. They score the try, they win the game, and the South African, the Springbok forwards, Lucas Strachan and Ben du Toit, put Sam Walker on their shoulders and carry him off the field in front of the stand in the stadium. And the Newlands crowd cheer the Lions to the echo. And, you know, and then later it appears, evidently at halftime, that some of the Springboks said to Donnie Craven, listen, we've got this game, we're ahead, they were ahead at halftime, let's just play conservatively. And it relates to what we've just been talking about in this tour. Donnie Craven says, we don't play rugby like that. We're gonna play open rugby. So they play open rugby and they lose. And Craven tells Walker afterwards, he says, you guys beat us fair and square. It was a great game. So that would be my two choices.
Oh, I must say, I really enjoyed working on the 1955 tour. A lot of the material I got from Cliff Morgan's autobiography and then also Tony O'Reilly's.
Cliff Morgan, he's most famous to us for his commentary in the 73 Barbarians, I think, isn't he? That fellow, yes. Edwards.
That's right. He was a big BBC man. I think he was in charge of the, you know, directing the wedding of Princess Di and them. I think he was in charge of the broadcast there. So he was quite popular in Britain. But anyway, the 55 Lions, interestingly enough, they were the first British Lions team to travel by plane to Africa. The others, as David wrote there, they came by boat. It took them a long time to get here and then back, of course, and then spend another 3 months, on tour. But anyway, they were known. They were a very popular side in South Africa because of the exciting rugby that they played. You know, they had wonderful backs like Seth Cliff Morgan, Jeff Butterfield, the England centre, Tony O'Reilly. He scored 16 tries in just 15 matches. So he was one of the heroes of the tour. And then the scrum half, Dickie Jeeps. You know, he was. He came to South Africa as an uncapped international player, but he played in all the tests. You know, he just adjusted so well. So he became the number one scrum half in the touring side.
Yeah, and then, legend.
Yeah, and they had a good pack of forwards, you know, guys like Bryn Meredith and Clem Thomas and Rhys Williams, that big lock. So they were an exciting team, you know, and they played themselves into the heart of the South African public. And the other thing that was that before the tour, Cliff Morgan said they decided they were going to be a singing team, you know, coming from Cliff Morgan, you can understand that.
Yeah, from the boy, yeah.
You know, so they practiced a lot before they left Britain, you know, and the repertoire even included Sari Mare, you know, the well-known Afrikaans song. And when they got to Jan Smuts, which is now Oliver Tambo Airport, when they got there, you know, there were lots, there were thousands of people, you know, welcoming them. And they sang Sari Mare, you know, and immediately they got into the hearts of the South African public. And then with a game they played, even more so. They won the first test, lost the second one. We've spoken about the first test, how exciting that was, how spectacular. They lost the second test and they won the third test, and then they lost the fourth test again. So if it had been a three-test series, they would have won the series, you know, yeah. if you think about it.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
About it. Anyway, they, well, like I said, you know, the attitude coming from Clive Morgan saying, you know, you have to take chances, you have to take risks. And something else that I remember that he said was that, you know, if there's brilliance, you can, even when there's brilliance, you can defend against it. But where there's mystery, you can't. And that is, you know, that's stuck in my head, you know, it's been stuck in my head for many years now. And like we said, that is what is missing in today's game. You know, there's no enterprise, there's no mystery there.
A few unknown quantities. Oh, there may be a couple in the Lions squad, but I don't think they get picked. It seems very safe. Anyway, I mean, that's a charm offensive, isn't it? That's wonderful winning over of the public. Maybe we associate rugby in South Africa with a different kind of offensiveness at times, and physicality is a big part of rugby out there. I mean, kind of borderline legal physicality. And if you come off second best in that kind of upfront clash, then you come off second best. Quite simply, has it always been like that? Is there any point where rugby in South Africa hasn't had that element to it?
No, I would say, you know, looking back, it's always been like that. If you think of the 62 Lions who came here, the 68 Lions, both those coaches, you know, they picked heavy forwards because they wanted to counter the physicality. And that's where they made the mistake, you know, because the South African loose forwards in 62, you had a fantastic number eight called Doug Hobwood. He was very fast, you know, very skilled. We haven't seen, you know, someone like him for many a year. So they, you know, they couldn't keep up the heavy forwards of the British pack. They couldn't keep up with the South African forwards, especially, you know, the loose field. The scores were, you know, quite close. You know, you had in 62, 68, you had a draw. You had 3 points difference here, 5 points difference there. It was only in 62 in the last test, you know, where there was a big margin. But it's been fairly close. But that physicality, it's always been there. And in 74, that was my other favorite team, Willie John and those guys. You know, they played New Zealand in New Zealand in 71, and they beat them there. So they came to South Africa with quite a reputation. Willie John said, you know, like he said in his foreword, we decided that, you know, this time we're not going to be intimidated physically. And they had the pack of forwards to counter the box, you know, actually to dominate them. And they had fantastic backs as well. You know, if you look at Gareth Edwards, you know, Phil Bennett, and, you know, JPR Williams, and the list just goes on and on. They were, you know, absolute legends, all-time legends, you know, of world rugby. So I don't think we ever had the players to beat them. The selectors, you know, they were falling around. After the first test, you know, that New Zealand, the Lions won 12-3 at Newlands in the wet, which obviously suited them. You know, they went on to win the next two games by big margins. You know, in fact, the second test at Loftus was the biggest hiding a Springbok team ever got. But they returned to Britain unbeaten. But the big thing was it was notorious for the 99 call. And Willie John, he said, you know, they decided that this time they're not going to be intimidated. And that's where they came up with this 99 call, you know, where if things got rough, and they needed to defend themselves or to gain the upper hand physically. They would just call 99 and it would be a free for all, you know, all for one, one for all. And
The principle being that the ref can't send everyone off, can he?
Yeah, that's correct. And in the third test in Port Elizabeth, you know, they had that, what they called the Battle of Buti Erasmus. Buti Erasmus was the name of the stadium. And, you know, everybody just piled in and you had a situation where J.P.R. Williams was running from fullback, you know. And
he was hairing half the length of the pitch to clog second row, didn't he?
Mix it with the forwards, you know. It was...
In a sudden flash, it all comes clear. It's a eureka moment, an epiphany. Hi, I'm Marcus Smith, host of the Constant Wonder podcast. The world offers marvel, meaning, and mystery around every single corner. In nature, art, science, culture, history, we talk everything from bees and beetles to obelisks and asteroids. Experience the thrill of transformative encounter. We'll bring more wonder to your day.
Listen to Constant Wonder wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, I think they'd had a sending off in the previous series where I think a single Welsh player had thrown a punch, been seen, and had a red card shown to him. And so you combat that by piling in, and that's been a sort of staple rule for amateur rugby clubs since then. Almost don't be the one person who throws a punch. Everyone pile in if you're all going to do it. I, of course, don't recommend this at all, by the way, if my coaches or referees are listening. That's the impact of that was great, wasn't it? I mean, that tour is, again, do we want to drift into more kind of political controversy? Maybe. There was an argument as to whether that tour would even go ahead. I think there were politicians certainly here who would rather the Lions had not gone to South Africa. In 1974, with the regime and apartheid going on, could anyone other than Willie John have led them? Do you think, with his kind of own personal experience, what was his kind of role as a leader there?
Look, he was, you know, if you think about it, he was, as they still call him, you know, he was the Lion of all Lions. He was he toured in 62, he toured in 68. And, you know, 71 and 74, you know, he's established himself like Alan Wynne-Jones now, you know, he's just way above the rest of any leaders in the Lions setup. He said, you know, he himself wasn't going to make any difference whether they go or not. They had their troubles in Ireland at the time. And he said, there was nothing he could do about the troubles in Ireland, you know. And obviously, Peter Hain at the time, you know, that 69-70 tour, you know, led by David de Villiers, you know, those demonstrations there, that was something terrible, you know, and they were probably afraid of something like that happening. In fact, the British government, they sort of distanced themselves from this tour. If I remember correctly, they instructed the embassy in South Africa not to entertain the Lions while they were on tour in South Africa. But when they got back to Heathrow, you know, everybody was there, including government officials, to welcome them back because, you know, this was quite a historical tour, you know, coming back unbeaten. And everybody wanted to be friends with the Lions.
I suppose Peter
Hain, of course, you know, he said he didn't agree with Willie John, for the Lions coming here. And as you remember, John Taylor, the flanker, he toured in 68 with the Lions in South Africa, but he didn't want to make himself available in 74. Then he changed his tune quite a bit.
Yeah, I suppose it's good.
Sorry, Andy. You know, I was just going to say there's a contradiction that, you know, apartheid became formalized when the National Party came to power in 1948. And so it takes time to, in 1955, there are no protests. But by, you know, into the 60s and certainly by the 70s, when the All Blacks came here in 1970 and in 76, there were huge protests. The rugby served as a kind of window to allow, there were protests in Cape Town when the All Blacks played here, there were protests elsewhere. And the interesting thing about the 74 Lions is, of course, that the people watching in England might not have known before, but a large percentage of South Africans, people of color, hugely supported them. So when the Lions scored a try at Newlands or won the game, a considerable percentage of the pop, of the, those present were delighted because they viewed it as an anti-apartheid act in a sense. So I think that was, you know, that is where this kind of contradiction comes in. And I suspect that as the tour went along, more and more people began to realize how complicated South Africa is at the time.
Yeah, I suppose you're bolting together a number of countries really to create a unified South Africa, aren't you? And yeah, that has been that way for some time.
Started in 1910. Sorry,
yeah,
no, you carry on.
It's interesting, you know, we were talking about 1971 when the Lions toured in New Zealand. South Africa was then touring Australia, you know, and they also came back unbeaten. But there were huge demonstrations. So, you know, the players, the British Lions players, they must have been very well aware of the implications playing a team like South Africa. You know, looking at what's been happening in Australia with the demonstrations at the time when they were touring New Zealand. So they did come here, you know, fully knowing what to expect, you know, what the background was, to the political background was. But at least they were coming to South Africa, you know, and Springboks weren't going to Britain in 74.
Sure. Yeah. And then you kind of fast forward to, we sort of skip a few years, but drift up to 97 and the kind of post-apartheid area, but also post-World Cup as well, post-World Cup triumph. Is there a kind of lightening of the mood in the 97 tour at least? Or is it just still focused and we're the world champions and we've got that reputation to defend now?
Yeah, it was you know, they were still the world champions, you know, at the time. And, you know, Gary Teichman, the Springbok captain then, were taken over from François Pienaar. He admitted, you know, he said, we just thought there was no ways these guys were going to beat us. They were so confident and all of that, you know. So when they lost the first test in, you know, at Newlands, they were totally shocked. You know, it was against all expectations, but they were well beaten. You know, the way the Lions swung the game towards the end. You know, the tries they scored, and then they lost the second test with Jeremy Guscott's famous drop goal. It was just by a point or so, but they lost the series right there. And Tyman said, he was devastated. He said he couldn't believe it, you know. And the 97 Lions would always be remembered for making the most with the players they had. They came here not with huge reputations like the 74 Lions and so on. They had some brilliant individuals, but, you know, as a team, they weren't seen as a team who could topple the Springboks, you know, especially after, you know, being the world champions. Nevertheless, they did. But what is interesting about that 97 crowd was that they brought some players, former rugby league players, about five or six of them, you know, guys like, yeah, there was Quinnell and then
Scott Gibbs,
Alan Tate, you know, and those guys. And they were supposed to instill a different kind of discipline into the squad, and which actually happened. So there they were different from previous squads, you know, and it obviously it seemed to have worked, you know, and won the series.
Yeah, it's that kind of image of Scott Gibbs sort of rolling and bouncing off Oz Durant.
That was quite something.
Yeah, and that kind of that tour just had the last little feel of amateurism about it. You know, we've seen the kind of court scenes with Keith Wood with the wig on acting as judge, and it just kind of has that last little feel of proper amateurism about it. And I think that's what the chapter title is in your book, Last Hurrah of Amateurism. But it had that kind of fun feel to it as well. And it's all a bit professional nowadays, but that's fine too.
Your question is a perceptive one. And, you know, Chris and I have written two other books, one about Newlands, one about Ellis Park. And we, with the team photos, it's interesting because in the 1890s and the early 1900s, the photos are very correct. The teams are Victorian almost, you know, and then we deliberately in our book on Newlands, we put in the photos of the 55 Lions and the 55 Springbok. It's really interesting. They're on a roof of a building and Table Mountain is behind them. And the guys are laughing. A lot of them are smiling. That you can see they, you know, the Springbok side was meant to be in a very happy side. And I think the Lions were, there's sort of an exuberance about it. And then especially on the South African side, as rugby becomes more politicized and the winning of games becomes in a sense for the Springboks, a defense of apartheid, the teams become more glowering, you know, and by the 80s, you know, there's not a smile on the face. And we remark upon that. And then again, I think you are right. I think there's in 97, it's a happier time. And it, you know, what we talked about at the beginning of this interview, the reaction now to, you know, what's going on, the type of rugby that's played, you know, it seems to be, there's too much professionalism in a sense. I that's putting it poorly, but I mean, it's Graham Henry in New Zealand. Is interesting. They asked him his opinion and he said, listen, because of the history of a Lions tour, it's become so huge that the winning and the losing of it is so important that you can't actually play the rugby you want to. And in a sense, we are hoist with our own petard. You know, we put, and our book is kind of part of that. You know, we're putting forward this pedestal, this history dating from 1891. The first international played in the Southern Hemisphere was played at Newlands in 1891. And here we are 130 years later, and it's a huge history. And I, in a sense, I think it doesn't make for good rugby.
Yeah, no, it does seem very focused on numbers and percentages and what's your tackle percentage and how, yeah, it's you just want a spark to come in at some point and you think it could do a job. But listen, as far as kind of the book goes, there's some things that I really, really like about it. I think I really like the way you kind of zoom in and zoom out on certain things. You know, for example, in the early days, the fact that the players went off and did a tour of Majuba, for example, you then kind of open that up into a little section which explains the significance of it and a bit of a political backdrop, which I think is really, really helpful. Actually, there's certain individuals, and this rumbles all the way through to the kind of modern era, like Brian O'Driscoll, like key figures, key players that you zoom in on as well. As far as kind of writing the book as a duo goes, do you have kind of clearly delineated spheres of interest, so there's no kind of clash or crossover? And do you enjoy working as a pair? It's clearly not the first time you've done it.
I'll go first. Yeah, this is our third book together. You know, but rugby kind of in a way lends it. I mean, Chris, I studied history at UCT at the University of Cape Town. Chris was a journalist. And, you know, when he writes about the later games, I mean, he was there, you know, he attended the press conferences. And, you know, I'm amazingly impressed with Chris's list of contacts. He knows a lot of people in rugby. So the division is quite easy, really. I do the earlier things. I did that in the Newlands book and the Ellis Park book, and Chris does the later one. So from that point of view, it's easy. And Chris is an easy person to work with.
Chris, you got something to add to that?
you know, it was this whole book was actually David's idea. And, you know, with the Lions tour coming up, I fully agreed with him, you know, that it's a good concept. And we submitted it to Amberley Publishers, and they came back, you know, they gave us the green light to carry on with this book, which was great. And it's really easy to work with David. He's a very conscientious researcher. He's, you know, he's very professional. He worked in the archives for a long time, so he knows his way around the archives, and you know, finding stuff in newspapers and wherever, you know. So it's really easy to work with him, and we've been through two books, the one on Newlands and the one on Ellis Park before, so you know, this was really not difficult at all.
Well, in that case, gents, I'll put out my own personal recommendation for the book. I've enjoyed reading it. Everyone knows what I like by now. If you're a regular listener, I like my First World War stuff. I like my rugby stuff. This covers conflict, political and rugby in depth. The narratives on the games are all really sound and illuminating. There's loads of detail on the individuals involved as well. And it's a really very readable and enjoyable thing. So thank you, Chris Schumann and David McLennan. It's been really, really lovely having you on. Best of luck for Saturday. not too much, maybe. But thank you very much for coming on. And I hope to see you book on shelves very, very soon.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Andy. It's been a pleasure being here.
Thank you.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them, and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.